privilege of hearing you last night. And so for our speaker this morning, I'd like to introduce his wife, Beverly. Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Beverly Douglas, and I am an alcoholic. And Diane, you got that backwards. He is Beverly Douglas's husband. Before I start off this morning, I'd like to thank the committee for having us here, and Judy and John. We came in a day early because we're getting old and we can't travel very well, and it was a long drive, and we had designated drivers, Jose and Sharon, and I want to thank them for driving us up here and taking us back. But Judy and John were so wonderful. God, they took care of all four of us, and we had beautiful rooms, and we got discounts off of our tickets, and he took us down and put us all four on the paddle boat with no charge, and God, it's just wonderful. And I'm going to give them a plug. I can't help it. You know, they're at the Rainbow Inn, you know, and they run and manage that, and it was just wonderful for us. And I can't tell you the love in my heart that my husband and I both have for Bart and Marilyn. Thanks a lot, Marilyn. And Marilyn and Phil, we met them years ago, and they've become very, very important in our lives. God, Debbie has just run around here. I've watched her running around, her and Diane, all over the place here. But we're real grateful that the committee has had the trust in us to hopefully carry a message of what I have learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I'm here to do this morning. I'm to carry the message to you of what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what you're going to find, but you see, I found something other than sobriety here. Sobriety was my main thing, but I have found many, many other things here, and I'm sure that each one of you have too, and the newcomers, the two young ladies that were here last night, I don't know whether they're here this morning, but I'm sure that you'll find something very wonderful in your new life as you begin this journey. As I said, I am an alcoholic, and I'm very proud to stand here before you this morning and tell you that I'm a sober woman alcoholic, because this wasn't the case a little over 29 years ago. I stood in a mental institution at that time, UCLA, up on the where Karen, our speaker, Friday night works, but I was in a different part of the hospital than she is. You know, I was over in the nut ward, and they called it NPI section. And up on the fifth floor, and I'd been there quite a while, and they let you go out on journeys if you've been on your good behavior. You know, they let little day trips and things. I see a couple of grins. I know a couple of you have been here. That particular day, it was aboard a fishing boat, and they were serving some booze aboard the boat. And even though we weren't supposed to drink, I seen some of the other patients doing it, so I figured, hell, if they could, I could too, you know. And needless to say, by the time I got back to the hospital that night, I was quite drunk. And they kept me downstairs and sobered me up a little bit before taking me up on the floor. And we had a new patient on our ward at that particular time, and for some reason I was very, very attracted to this woman. But she was different from the rest of us. She had something called alcoholism, and I'd never heard of that before. Anyway, when I went up to my room, she followed me in my room, and she looked over at me, and she said, "Beverly, I think you're an alcoholic." Well, now, I want you to know I have never been so insulted in my life. And I told Lenore in no uncertain terms that, by God, she needn't lay her thing on me. I was crazy. You know. But, you see, I really meant it then. I really meant it. I didn't know what this thing was, you know, of an alcoholic. But I certainly would rather have been called crazy. In fact, I was so insulted when I seen my doctor the next day. I told him what Lenore had to say to me. And I said, "Now, Dr. Valentine," I said, "what do you think about that?" And he said, "Nah, Beverly," he said, "if you can just learn to face reality and cope with some of these problems you had." Well, hell, I had been till they got me in there. You know, I drank. That was how I faced all these things and coped with these things. But anyway, you know, he said that he couldn't see where I had any problem with alcohol, and he was the boss. It sure sounded right to me. So I was to drink for another 3.5 years after that. I won't tell you a little about my background. As you can tell, I don't really speak good English. I speak Southern. And it's a little bit worse sometimes than it is in others. I was down in Virginia here a couple of weeks ago with my daughter and spent some time down there. And Hugh said, "I'm just getting where he can begin to understand me again now." But anyway, I had two older brothers. I come from Florida, is where I come from. And somebody asked me, you know, they come up to me after the meeting. I couldn't believe what they said. And they said, "I thought you said you come from the South." Well, you know, I don't know how much further south you can get from Florida. You know, that's as far as it goes. But anyway, I remember Daddy saying one night at the supper table, he said, "When you kids get old enough to go out and go to work and earn your own money and buy your own cigarettes and your own booze with, as far as I'm concerned, you're old enough to drink and smoke." Well, hell, needless to say, I went to work at a real early age. You know, I was 13 about that time, and what had happened was that the war had started, and for any of you young people that was here, that was the Second World War, not the first one. I won't, get that one straight out right now. It's bad enough as it was. Anyway, you know, I hear a lot of people say they drink for many reasons. I don't remember drinking for any particular reason. It was just that when that particular war, and I'm sure there are some of you here that remember that, it was like the whole world just went on a party. It was a very popular war, and I just joined the party. Only thing was, is when the party was over, I never went home. I still haven't. I love parties, you know. The only difference is today I don't drink. I'm still the first one there and last one to leave, you know. But I just don't drink. Now, by the time I was 16, I was a blackout drinker. I was also pregnant and married, just in that order. Now, today, heck, I guess if you got to get married, getting pregnant is as good a reason as any, at least down our neck of the woods, either that or go on welfare. But when most of them go on welfare, too, come to think of it. Anyway, when I was growing up, nice girls didn't do those things. But I got to tell you, remember I told you I was a blackout drinker? Believe me when I tell you, I was almost 4 months pregnant before I even knew I'd been had. I kid you not. And the way I found out, I was doing waitress work at the time, and I would go serve breakfast, you know, to a customer, and then I'd go throw up. And then I'd come out, and I'd serve another breakfast, you know, and then I'd go throw up. And the boss was standing there watching the action, and he came over and informed me he didn't think it was too conducive, you know, for good business, and suggested I see a doctor. And we had family doctors back then, and I did. You know, I figured, well, I had flu or something, you know. I went in to see him, and he said, "Now, Beverly, when you finish dressing, I want to see you in my office." And I thought, fine, you know, no big deal. And I went into his office, and he was sitting in, they had those big old oak desks, you know, at that time, and he was a great big man anyway. And he looked over at me, and he leaned over that desk, and he looked me right straight in the eye, and he said, "Beverly, you're pregnant." Well, now, I thought about that for a few minutes, and I just leaned over that desk, and I looked him right straight back in the eye, and I said, "Dr. Moses, I can't be. I've never been with a man." Well, now, he thought about that for a few minutes. And he just leaned over that table and looked me right straight in the eye again, and he assured me I was not the second Virgin Mary. I was real sorry to hear that. Anyway, I did marry that man. I lost that baby, and I wasn't to get pregnant again for another 6 years. Same husband. But it was a real drunken marriage. Real bad. I did get pregnant again, as I said, and when my baby was 6 weeks old, I had gone to the doctor, the same doctor, Dr. Moses, and he told me my nose was sitting sideways, my eye was black, you know how I'm sure some of you have been there. Anyway, and he said, "Beverly," he said, "you two really ought to separate." He said, you know, he said, "one of you's going to kill the other one one of these days if you don't." So, and he said he's an habitual drunkard. And he's going to get worse. He's never going to get better. I never remember hearing the word alcoholic or alcoholism at that time. He called him an habitual drunkard. I wrote Mama a letter, and Mother was down here in California at the time, and I wrote her a letter, and she sent me a one-way ticket. I had a very wise mother. No money, just a one-way ticket. And so I took my baby, and I came out to California. I started back in with what I call social drinking. Now, one thing I had learned out of that marriage is that you don't go to bed with men first. You marry them first. And I got to tell you, when I left that man when she was only 6 weeks old, by the time she was four, it had been a long, dry summer. I kid you not. And I decided she needed a father and I needed a husband. And I met this beautiful, young, Irish Catholic boy. Oh, he was wonderful. And him and I got married. Now, we all know that all Irish Catholics are alcoholics. Heck, they're all in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Would you believe I married the only Irish Catholic boy that didn't drink? I mean, this boy did not drink. And he had come home from work one night when we'd been married for less than a year, and he looked down at me, and he said, "Honey," he said, "I love you very much, but," he said, "I can't take this drinking of yours." And he said, "Either I've got to go or it's got to go." Well, I said goodbye to Paul. What else do you do, you know? And anyway, Mom and I were back together again. Now, in AA and the clubhouses, you see a lot of cliches up on the wall, like Easy Does It and First Things First, you know. And I know that some people don't understand cliches, but I knew all about them because my mama used to have a lot of cliches when I was a kid growing up, and one of hers was, "If you don't succeed at first, you try again." And as I was coming out of my second marriage, Mama was coming out of her fourth one. Well, I mean, Mama was like us. I mean, she just didn't say cliches. She lived them, you know, like we do. And anyway, I had just put the baby to bed, and Mama looked over at me, and she said, "You know, honey," she said, "I think we ought to get ourselves some kind of a business." And sounded like a terrific idea to me. I had a little bit of cash. Mama had a AAA credit rating, so we did. We bought a business. A liquor store. What else do two alkies do, you know? So anyway, the fun really began, because what had happened is by this time in my life, I was into the morning drink. And instead of getting well now with a morning drink, what was happening is I was getting drunk all over again, and I couldn't afford to do that because I had that baby to support and take care of, and I had a lunch job, and beside that, we had the liquor store now. And but it was okay because, you see, I fell in love again. And, well, we all know what I was doing was falling in heat, but and I think that Karen talked a little bit about that. Patting me on the head didn't do it, but they always knew what did. Anyway, this man introduced me to a thing called the barley sandwich. Is there anybody here that knows what a barley sandwich is? That's beer and tomato juice. You're looking like it doesn't taste good. Honey, I got to tell you, it didn't taste good. But you see, it worked. And that was all I was interested in. Alcohol was the only consistent thing at this time in my life that I had going for me. Husbands were coming and going. Jobs were coming and going. Friends were coming and going. But alcohol was consistent. Now, I did marry this man. You notice I married them. You know, if it sounds like I got another little problem running around here, I do. I'll talk about it a little later on. But anyway, I did marry him. Now, I want to tell you that we had only been married a little over a year, and I began to have some of the darndest, funniest things happening to me. I got up one morning, and I was making the bed, and the bedspread was wet. And I thought, well, darn, that's funny. I don't have any coffee or water or anything in here, you know. So I felt up to see how the mattress was. Have you ever, you know, kind of worried about the mattress was wet? Anyway, it wasn't. But I had to go to work. I was a moving drunk. And I got to tell you, drunk or sober, I had two things in my life that motivated me into taking an action. And those two things were fear and pain. Drunk or sober, fear and pain will motivate me into taking an action. I walked into the bathroom to get dressed for work, and I looked in the mirror, and I wasn't crying. It was like somebody had just turned on two water faucets. The water was just pouring down out of my face, and I thought, God, you know, and I couldn't stop it. And but you see, it set up a fear in me, you know, when you're out of control and you don't even know that you are, and until you look in a mirror, for gosh sakes. But I had my fixer, and I just walked into the bar and poured myself a couple of hookers, and that was the shot glasses, kids, you know, for you young ones here. And the water just shut off, and I went on into the bathroom, got dressed for work, and went on to work. Well, now, I came home from work, and I went to walk into the living room, and I got in there, and my stomach, have you ever had that, you know, when you're coming off of a drunk where your stomach just sort of jumps around? Well, it didn't just jump around. I mean, my whole body started going with it, and I looked like I was doing the St. Vitus dance, and I couldn't get stopped. I had never been so nervous in my life. And it set up a terrible fear in me, and I thought, my God, what is this? But you see, I knew what to do. I had my fixer. All I had to do was to get to it, you know. And I finally got my body jerked in the right direction, hopped on back into the bar back there, and I always had a bar in my house. But anyway, and I went to pour myself a drink, couldn't get it poured, went to try to drink it out of the bottle, darn near and bit the top, he's sitting back there, he knows what I mean, almost bit the top of the bottle off, and thank God I had one of those from the liquor store, a great big champagne glass, not a brandy snifter, but a big opened, you know, champagne glass, got some booze poured in there, got my face down in there, and got enough in me that the body began to slow down, you know. And I thought, God damn, boy, you know, what was that? Because I'd never had anything like that before. And I had a few more drinks, and I finally, you know, got myself together, and the fear went away. You know, if we get enough drinks in this hell, who's afraid, you know? We're immortal. But anyway, I went on in the kitchen, fixed dinner. Now, a few days later, what happened was I'd laid down for a nap before dinner, and I woke up, and I was on the floor, and I had wet all over myself, had mucus all in my hair, and I was scared half to death. Now, I was vaguely aware that this was not the first time that something like this had happened to me. And so I went in, though, because, again, I had to go for my fixer, and I went into the bar, and I poured myself a couple of drinks, and I was still full of fear. And I poured a couple more, and the fear was still there. So I did the only logical thing. I called my doctor, and he said, get a cab. Don't try to drive, and come on in and see me. Well, they ended up diagnosing me as having epileptic seizures. And they listed me as manic depressive, which our book says that it can write chapters about. Now, you and I know that what I was having, although I didn't know it at the time because I didn't know anything about alcoholism, is that alcohol, you know, what I was having was alcoholic convulsions, for God's sake. And alcohol had induced the manic depression. Now, that was how I got out to UCLA, and as I said, I was to drink for another 3.5 years. Now, I want to take you into my moment of clarity. This one particular night, I was living in the same home that I'm living in today, and this particular night, my daughter was away for the weekend, and I was waiting on my then-husband to come home. And he was about 5 or 6 hours late. We gals all know where you guys are when you're 5 or 6 hours late coming home from work. Yeah, sure we do. You're out with her, huh? The ones who understand you. Yeah, sure. Don't you sit back there and laugh, honey, because some of us were the ones who understood them. You betcha. Yeah. Anyway, I had waited as long as I could, and I decided to have a drink, and, you know, I'd only had a couple, you know how we are, and here he come, you know. And he walked over to me, and he looked down at me, and he said, you're drunk, and I'm not going to take you anywhere. And with that, he went on up into the bedroom and passed out. Well, I fixed myself another drink, and I walked from the den up into the kitchen, and our kitchen faces the front of the house there, and I looked out in the driveway, and there were two brand new cars sitting in that driveway, and I walked through my home, and it was a brand new home and newly decorated from Sloan's over in Beverly Hills, you know, and it was the kind of a home that if you opened up the book of Better Homes and Gardens, you'd see one very similar to it in that book. And I walked on out into the backyard, and I stood there, and it was beautifully landscaped and well manicured. You know, it was the kind of a yard that belonged in the home that belonged in the book of the Better Homes and Gardens, you know. And if you'd have seen us as a family, my daughter and my husband and myself, that's what we presented to the world, this family that belonged in that yard, that belonged in that home, that belonged in that book of the Better Homes and Gardens. That's the way we lived. That was the phoniness of because he was as bad as I was, you know. But I stood there in that yard that night, you know, and I remember looking up and crying out, why God, why now, when I've got everything that I've always wanted all of my life, all these things, why do I want to die? And, you know, I couldn't have told you that night. But this morning I can. You know, what good is all you've got, all of those things, if there is no joy in them? And alcohol had taken every bit of the joy right out of my life. It had taken me into a living hell of which I could find no way out of. Now, I wasn't out on the streets like Karen was, but the next day I would have been. You know, that's where I was. And I went on back down into the den and fixed myself another drink. You know, I think that Christ said something like that to the best of my memory when he said, what profits a man who gains the world and then loses his very soul? And that's what had happened to me. I had lost my very soul. I sat there with that drink in my hand, and for the first time, with all of the things that had happened to me, I was fully consciously aware it was not the husband, the friends, or the kids, the, you know, whatever that we always blame our problems on, that it was that alcohol that I had there in my hand. Can you imagine? Of course you can. You've been there. For the first time in my life, I was so fully aware that it was that alcohol that had taken me into this living hell. And at that very moment, I knew if I kept on drinking, I was going to die. But I also knew if I stopped drinking, I was going to die. Well, what the heck do? You can't drink any more and you can't drink any less. I did the only thing I knew to do that night. I killed myself. Now, I say that facetiously, and yet for me, I believe that that really happened. If this book is true and it talks about being reborn again, I think that it was right there is where I was reborn again. I woke up 3.5 days later in County General Hospital. I say I woke up, hell, I came to. No alky ever wakes up. I had tubes out my nose, my throat, both arms and both ankles. And I'm trying to talk through all of this, you know, because first question is what, right? Where am I? First question. And there was a policeman standing over in the door, and he looked over at me and he said, you're in County General Hospital. And I said, well, how in the world did I get there? I live in Chatsworth. We have insurance. We have money. You know, what am I doing in County General Hospital? And he walked over and he looked down at me with the most disgusted look on his face. God, people were always looking down at me. And, you know, and he said, lady, he said, committing suicide's against the law. Well, now, I didn't know that. I might not have done it, you know. But anyway, my doctor had, they put you on hold for doing things like that. They think there's something the matter with you. Anyway, my doctor, my psychiatrist, who I'd been going to now because they had recommended him when I came out of the nut ward, I'd been going to him for 3.5 years, and he sent word to the hospital that as soon as I was well enough and they released me, that he wanted me immediately in his office. So Mama took me up there to him, and he looked over at me, and he shook his head. And he said, Beverly, you need help, and you need it desperately. And he said, I can't help you. And he said, here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you call them? Well, now, I was a little disturbed by this time because, you know, I had been going to this man for 3.5 years, as many sometimes as 3 times a week, at $60 a whack. I had almost killed myself, drank myself to death, and he had the nerve to sit there and tell me he couldn't help me. You know, I was a little upset. But anyway, he was the boss, and I took the number of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him I'd call. Now, from now on, I'm going to talk about a book here, and this book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics, and it's written about alcoholism, period. That's it. Now, I got a couple of little pet peeves, and I want to get rid of them right off top. I have heard people say, today I have a living problem. I no longer have a drinking problem. If you're an alcoholic of my kind, for Christ's sake, if somebody says something like that to you, run. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was dying from alcoholism. Not because of my living problem, but alcoholism. I was physically dying from it. Now, I have living problems. Do you know, you don't have to be an alcoholic to have living problems. All you have to do is be alive. you know, just breathing in and out. You know, everybody has living problems. We're not immune from living problems simply because we've gotten sober and some people seem to think that we should be. No. You know, I'm alive today and I'm living life, and life does have its problems. But what this book teaches me is how to stop doing what I've been doing. You ever heard that old saying? Of course you have. You know, if you're hurting, stop doing what you're doing that's causing you to hurt. You know, I want to hit somebody every time they used to tell me that when I was new. What do you mean? That's totally unacceptable. I want to do what I want to do and get by with it. I'm sober now. You know. Like baloney. Baloney. Anyway, I have one more. And then I'll get on with what I want to talk about here today. And we've got a guy on the other side of our hill, and I won't mention Clancy's name. And, you know, and I heard him one day, and I wasn't too long on the sober on the program, and it... I took him for what he said as gospel truth, you know. And he leaned back and said from a podium, he said, "You can work this program any way you want to." Well, now, I thought about that for a little while, and I thought, darn, you know, I read something different in this book. And if you hear anybody say that, you know right off top, they're not reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in this book, and my husband said something about it last night, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. There's only one path. What do you mean we can work it any way we want to? That's not what my book says. I was a little upset with this, you know, when I heard it because I couldn't quite understand, and I'm sure he knows what he meant, and he meant good by it. But I just heard it in a different way, and I understand that newcomers do hear things differently than what sometimes we speakers, mean to say or convey to them. But anyway, I just knew if I couldn't understand that I was going to end up drunk. And so I call my sponsor, you know, and I'm nattering away 90 miles a minute, you know, trying to get some understanding, you know, and knowing I'm going to get drunk. And if you ever just been flying up your own ass and knew you was going to get drunk, you know, and you call your sponsor up and they tell you something like this, "Read the book, honey. The answers are in the book." If you ever had them do that to you, you just want to, you know, let them have it, you know. And anyway, that's what she said to me. So what I did then was that I got back in the book. And let me tell you what I found in the book in here. And, you know, when it said, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. My question was, is what path are, you know, what are you talking about? And I got back in the book, and let me tell you what I found. Now, I want to preface this. Is that I am not up here this morning to tell anybody what they're going to find in this big book for them, nor what they're going to have to do, are you, in order to stay sober. I'm only here telling you the things that I have found and the things that I've had to do in order for me to stay sober. But one thing that I do want to emphasize is this. I don't care how much you read this book. I don't care how much you talk about it in meetings or spout about it like I'm doing here this morning from the podium. Until you take what you've read and apply it to your life, live it, it has absolutely no value at all. None. The spiritual life is not a theory. It must be lived, or it has no value. Now, what I found in here when I got back in here is the path they were talking about. It says, a lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, it uses words like exactly, specifically, absolutely, and it even goes on to say that it gives clear-cut directions. Now, that really doesn't leave any room for the fertile imagination of an alky to run around in. I mean, it's got you right by the you-know-wheres, you know. And there I was. Now, it goes on from there. And it says, we have written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual. Now, I don't know what that's going to come to mean to you or what it does mean to you. I can only again tell you what it came to mean to me. You see, I don't believe that my drunkenness was a moral issue. I have come to believe that my sobriety is. And so therefore it behooved me to find out what my morals were. And I gotta tell you, you know, the first thing that I heard when I got into AA was buy a book. That first thing you heard? And so I did. I got into a meeting and I bought the big book and I brought it home and I gave it a place of honor right in the middle of the coffee table. And then the next thing I heard when I went to meetings was get pamphlets and take them home and read them. You know, so I did. I brought them home and I read them and I put them all around my big book right in the middle of the coffee table, place of honor. And then I'd go to more meetings and I'd get more pamphlets and I'd bring them home and I'd put them on the night or on the end stands on the couch, you know, on each end. And then I went to some more meetings and I got some more pamphlets and I brought them home and I read them. And those were real good ones. And I put them on his side of the bed on the nightstand, right? You gals have done that. You betcha you have. Anyway, and the next thing I heard was get a sponsor. Well, I did. I got me a sponsor. You know, she was one of those kind of sponsors that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Y'all got some of those up here too, huh? She was a whip. I kid you not. Anyway, she came and told me, she said, Beverly, when you go on to meetings, she said, if they should call on you by mistake, she said, you stand up, you tell them your name, and you tell them what's wrong with you, and then you sit down because that's all you know, honey. Now, she called me up this particular day, and she said, Beverly, I'm coming over to talk to you. And when she called and said she was coming to talk to me, I knew that's what she meant. She was going to do the talking. Now, she came in my home, it was first time there, and she sat down right in the middle of that couch, right in front of that coffee table where my big book was. She looked over at it. She looked down at me. She reached over, and she wiped the dust off of it, and she handed it to me, and she said, here, honey, read it. Well, now, nobody had said read it. They just said buy it. And so I did, and I started reading it, and that was one of the first things I found. Now, I know that some of you didn't hear what I had to say, and I know that some of you didn't want to hear what I had to say there. So watch my lips, okay? I'm going to repeat it. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourself that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, I went to some meetings with Eunice, and I began to understand a little bit about what she was saying. Not much, but just a little bit. And I'm going to be a typical alcoholic, okay? And my husband talked a little bit about it last night, you know, is that alcoholics do things backwards. So I'm going to start with the 12th step and to kind of explain a little bit how my program went and the things that I had to learn. Because I like to talk about morals, values, and principles that I have learned and the things that I've had to find and apply in my life in order for me to stay sober. Okay. Now, in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now, one of the first things that I began to hear was how this program works, the H-O-W of how the program works. And so I thought, well, what are they talking about? You know, and again, I got back into the book. And in the first step, when it talked about, I found the principle of honesty in there, because in there it talks about, you know, how when we can fully admit that we are alcoholics and that our life is unmanageable. Now, up to this point, I could not quit drinking. I could not quit drinking. I wanted to many times, desperately. I could not quit. I had drank myself into such a small whirl of alcoholism, and I almost couldn't find my way back out. And the people that I cared about the most, of course, those are the ones, you know, that are the closest to us, the ones that we love the most, were the people that I was most unkind and destructive with. And in the mornings when I would wake up, the horror and the remorse and the hopelessness that I would feel that next day, there are no words. I don't even need words to describe it. You know what I'm talking about. And when I wanted to quit so desperately and I could not get off of the juice, the loneliness and the despair that we have all felt. Again, there's no words that describe it. I got into that first step, and you know, when, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I came to you to find out what an alcoholic was. I went to my doctor and I asked him, and God, they didn't know. You know, I'm talking about 26 years ago almost. And my doctor really didn't know. He gave me some stuff, you know, about, well, you make yourself sick and this, that, and the other. But, you know, and I come to you, and you said, if you were an alcoholic, Beverly, we can show you how to stay sober. We can show you how to stay sober. And if you stay sober, we can guarantee you a better life. So in this, you know, when I came to these meetings and you'd ask for the hands of alcoholics, in the beginning I wouldn't raise my hand because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But in time I began to understand from you, and I knew I was one. And when I was honestly able to admit for the first time, honestly able to admit down in my gut, not just down in my mouth, I was able to set aside the juice. Just put it aside for the first time since I was 13 years old, and I was 35 when I got here. That makes me 61, in case anybody's figuring it out. And lucky to have lived so long, too. I'll tell you, if I'd have kept on with the drinking, I sure as heck wouldn't be here this morning. But anyway, I began to understand what honesty was, and I had learned the first of the how this program works. Then I went into the second step where it said came to believe that a power could restore us to sanity. Didn't say would, just said he could. And my husband down there keeps insisting that it hasn't happened yet, you know, but he still holds out hope, you know. So anyway, in that step, I began to hear the word spiritual. Now, my first thought when you started talking with words like that was, oh, you know, here we go. You know, we're back into a religion here. I knew religion did not work. I had tried all kinds of churches, and they were a bunch of hypocrites as far as I was concerned, and I could not buy 100% into their doctrines of any of the churches, so therefore I wouldn't go. They weren't any help to me. The book told me, it said, Beverly, you don't have to buy it all right now. Just keep an open mind. That's all I had to do, was simply keep an open mind. So thank God my sponsor was the kind that said, Beverly, look words up in a dictionary. Don't assume the meaning of a word. So I got into the dictionary and I looked up the word spiritual. And in the dictionary I was in, and I'm very grateful for that, it took it right out of the religious connotation, and it gave me a meaning that I could accept. It said, being spiritual is simply an elevation of thought and feeling. I thought, God, you know, from the kind of a drunken woman I was when I kept to you people and sobered up, that just automatically happened. I automatically had an elevation of thought and feeling. No effort on my part. It just came about. So now I had honesty and open-mindedness. I had two of the three essentials of how this program works. Now, from there, I went into my third step, and it said, made a decision, you know, to turn my life and my will over to God. And I thought, oh, God, here we go again. Don't you people know that this God thing doesn't work? There was too many Catholic priests in here. Just too many Catholic priests, you know. And the little nunny bunnies were running around in here also, you know. And so that proved to me that it didn't work. But again, fear and pain were back in my life. Fear and pain. And my sponsor had told me, she said, honey, she said, you were a phony when you were out there drinking. And now, by God, that you're sober, you're going to stop being a phony. And you come in here and you're going to tell it like it is. And I told you people I didn't believe in God. I didn't disbelieve exactly, but I was real iffy with it, you know. And you said, well, that's okay, Beverly, you know, just act as if. And I was a little confused again. And I said, well, now my sponsor said stop being a phony. You're telling me to act as if. I said, now what do I do here? And then they reminded me that I was supposed to keep an open mind, you know. But what helped more than anything else is that fear and pain was back in my life again, and I was scared to death that if I didn't come to believe in this God that you talked about, that I was going to get back on the juice again. And thank goodness I remembered something that I had read as a child, and I don't remember where I read it, but I'm sure that some of you have read it also, and it went something like this. I would rather live my life as though there was a God and die and find out that there wasn't, than to live my life as though there was no God and then die and find out that there was. Now, I don't know what that does for you. Scared the hell out of me. And I decided I was going to act as if. Okay? So fear and pain has been a wonderful thing in this drunk's life, I'll tell you. Anyway, this sponsor was hauling me all over the place, and she had told me she wanted me to go to certain types of meetings. She said, there's four different kinds of meetings I want you to go to. And she said, other than that, once you fulfill those for the week, then, you know, you're free to go to choose whatever you want to. And she named off, you know, a book study meeting and a participation meeting. And then she got up to a woman's stag meeting. Well, now, I mean, right there, we were going to come to the parting of the ways. She said a woman stag, and I told her, I said, Eunice, there is no way that I'm going to go into those PTA meetings with those gossiping, backstabbing bitches. And that's the way I felt about it, and I have learned that there's many women that feel the same way about it. And she just looked over at me, and she said, you are going. Well, I went, you know. And I got to tell you that when I went to those PTA meetings in the beginning, I did find some gossiping, backstabbing bitches. However, what I also found was some very warm, wonderful women who literally saved my life. Now, you gals that have been in here for a little while, you know that the men will help you with your spiritual program. Sure you do. But if you're new, you know, save them till later on, because you're going to need a good basic program before you get involved in that, I'll tell you. Anyway, you know, we were sitting and outside, well, we weren't outside. The meeting was over at one of these PTA meetings, and Eunice always had a little entourage around her. And we were sitting there, you know, kibitzing back and forth. And I think that what I did, I can't really remember, but I think I threatened her with getting drunk. And she looked over at me and she said, let me tell you something, honey. If you decide to drink and get drunk again, I want you to know I'm not responsible for that. Well, I thought about it for a few minutes, you know, and I kind of shrugged it off. And I thought, well, okay, you know. And we had a few more words. I must have said something smart to her again. And she got up and walked away. And she came back and she looked down at me. And she said, let me tell you something, honey. She said, I just remembered you're suicidal, too. And if you decide to drink and get drunk and commit suicide, I'm not responsible for that either. Well, now, that upset me a little bit. And I looked over at her and I said, well, you're my sponsor. What the hell are you responsible for? I mean, they got to be good for something, you know. And she reached over and she picked up my book and she shook it right down. And my face hit me right across the bridge in the nose here. I'd like to think she really didn't mean to do that. And she said, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this book and how to apply it to your life. I thought, well, you know, she had me there. I had no comeback for it, you know. So anyway, that was where we went with the book. You know, there was a clubhouse that I went to there in the valley later on. And we were sitting there in the meeting, and the night before, my mother and my daughter had been going through the dictionary, because once my sponsor had got me into it, they got very involved in it also, in my sobriety. And They come up with the words, how I was when I was married to somebody, or even how I was with just people, period, was two words, submissive and subservient, you know. And they were reading the definitions of this out of the dictionary. So when I went to this particular meeting the next day, I was talking about this, how submissive and subservient I had been, and I wasn't too sure, you know, whether it was good for me or not. And so anyway, there was a young man sitting in this meeting, and he was sitting there drumming on the table, and, you know, he was impatient. He wanted me to shut up so he could talk like he had something important to say. And, you know, when I did finish talking, they called on him, and he stood up, and he pointed his finger at me like that, and he said, "Lady, did you ever stop to think that all you ever really was just a kiss-ass?" Well, he hurt my feelings. But I got even with him. I married him almost 20 years ago. So you guys better be careful, because we women do have a way of getting even. We may be slow on it sometimes, but we get there. Anyway, I was... Eunice had been talking to me, and she said, "You know, honey," she said, "there is a clubhouse here in the valley." And she said, "I don't want you going there. There's a bunch of dirty old men there helping women with their spiritual program." I do hope y'all have one of those up here somewhere. Anyway, so I didn't go there. Because, you see, when I came to you people, I was married. And when I'm married, I'm married. Now, when I'm single, that's something else. Anyway, she had told me, she said, "Honey," she said, "I want you to get a good, firm, basic program. I don't want you making any major decisions for at least a year. And in your case, you're sicker than most. I want you to wait 3. I kid you not, that's what she told me. And I'm glad she recognized that fact. Because remember, I'd been over at the Nut House. I forgot to tell you this, too. You know, what I come to find out from that after I got here to you people is that alcohol will induce the same exact symptoms so closely of many emotional and mental illnesses that even doctors and psychiatrists cannot tell the difference. It will induce these. Now, it will also cover them up. Okay? So if you've been here for 6 months or more, or even less, and you're having problems in this area, for God's sake, don't go to another alcoholic and ask them what you should do about it. Get to a doctor or a psychiatrist. The alcoholic will tell you, and they're liable to kill you. You know, we got the answer for all things in here. No, we don't. We're not doctors. We're not lawyers. We're not marriage counselors, although sometimes we act as such. But, you know, get to a doctor and find out, you know, what it is. Because when you get sober and the alcohol is gone, your problems will, and I'm not talking about, you know, life's problems. I'm talking about mental or emotional problems, real problems, you know, will come forth. So anyway, I want to get back, though, to this, was that she said, "I don't want you making any major decisions, you know, for at least 3 years," and she said, "and don't get emotionally involved." Well, I thought she meant with a guy, you know, and I said, "Don't worry about it, Eunice. Remember, I told you I'm married." And she says, "Well, I'm not necessarily talking about that." She said, "You just don't get emotionally involved with people, and especially with newcomers, because if you do, and they're liable to end up getting drunk on you, and you might end up joining them, you know." And I hear a lot of stuff today, you know, about emotionally involved with a newcomer, like you're going to go off and have an affair with him or something. You know, and that wasn't, you know, what it was originally, as I understand it, meant to be when they said emotional involvement. It was just simply that if you got emotionally involved and they got drunk, you're liable to go out with them. And they didn't want this to happen. And then she added this little addendum onto what she was telling me. And she said, "And as I said, honey, there's a clubhouse here. And, you know, and I want you to stay away from there." So I did. Like I said, I was in a 13-year marriage, and I didn't go around there. Now, what happened was is that after I'd been married for about, after I'd been sober for about 3 years, I had to go through a divorce. Now, and I'm not up here recommending divorce for anything or anyone, because I have seen marriages where one or both are, you know, have gotten sober, and it's just like they met each other all over again, you know, and fell in love again. And but for me, it wasn't to be that way. It was necessary. It was either get back on the juice again, or get out of the marriage. He was a drinker, but that wasn't where my problem was. He was also a womanizer, and that seems to go with most people, men, if they're good drinkers. Until they get where they can't perform anymore, they keep it up here, but the rest of their body doesn't go with it. And thank God we women have nothing to get ready, not even our minds, so, you know, we have no problem in that area. But anyway, I got to tell you a little joke. I hope y'all will bear with me. This is terrible for a spiritual meeting, but here goes anyway. It just seems that it's so apropos right here. You know, there was a little doggy. And they got two of the cutest doggies. I'm sure everybody's seen them. Anyway, this particular little dog lived with family by a railroad track. And he woke up this one morning, and it was a beautiful spring day outside, you know, kind of like it was this morning, you know. And he wanted to go play, so he scratched on the door, you know, and he let out a couple of yips, and his owner got up, you know, and came over and let him out. And he ran up on this little hill here where a railroad track was, you know, and he went running along the railroad track, you know, and he was sniffing at the weeds and sniffing at the flowers, and his little ears were just flapping back, you know, and he was just having the most wonderful time. And a train come along and cut off a little tiny weeny piece of his tail. Well, now, he lit out a yip, and he turned around to see what happened to that little tiny piece of tail, and a train come along from the other direction and cut off his head. Now, honeys, don't you be like that little dog and lose your head over a little tiny piece of tail, huh? Well, isn't that the truth, you know, and I don't care how young or how old you are, isn't that what goes on? You know, I don't care whether you're 6 or 96, man, woman, or child, when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you come in here with two problems, and one of them is bad breath and a broken heart. Booze and sex, if you will, in plain language. Now, I hope I'm not going to be offensive to anybody here this morning talking about this at a Sunday morning meeting, but I don't think it's talked about enough, and I don't think that age has a lot to do with it, because I've seen people, Hughes and my age, for God's sake, that get into just as much trouble as the young people sometimes. Now, as I said, my sponsor had told me to stay away from this clubhouse because of these spiritual guys helping women with their program, and I didn't go around it until I got a divorce. Now, I went through a divorce after I was 3 years sober, and that's the first place I headed. Hell, I'm not dumb, you know. And I got in there, and I sat down, and I looked around, and I was just like a little kid in a candy store, and I said, I'll have him, 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 and him, you know. And I recognized I was in trouble. I was in heat again. Now, that has always gotten me into trouble. And I knew I had to do something about it, because one more time in my life, fear and pain was there. Fear and pain was back in my life. Now, I know that in here there are some gurus this morning. Would anybody care to point them out to me? Well, I brought one along with me. Now, if you've just been in the program for a short while, one of the first thing that these gurus tell you guys is to stay away from the women, right? Because behind every slip, there's a skirt. Isn't that what they tell you? Honey, don't you sit back there and grin, because behind every slipper, there's a zipper, too. I mean, that thing goes two ways. And I knew I was in trouble, and I knew I needed to do something about it. But I didn't not, you know, I wasn't quite sure what I needed to do. Now, one of the first things I did, you know, because I'd started thinking by this time I was 3 years sober, you know, and God help you when you start thinking. You're in trouble for sure. Anyway, what I figured was I had started sponsoring some women of my own by this time, and I was teaching them the same thing that my sponsor had taught me, and that is, you know, you get a good firm basic program. You don't get emotionally involved, you know, with any of the newcomers, and you don't make any major decisions for at least a year. But what I added on to that was, honey, if you need to get laid, that's all right. You know, oh, I'm so glad you laughed. You think like I do. See, what I figured was if she could get laid without getting emotionally involved, she could come back and tell me how, and I'd be okay, right? It didn't work. And you guys needn't laugh. I ain't seen y'all do any better. I haven't seen you do any better at all. You see, because we get caught up in these little affairs because they have such potential. Oh, God, I want to throw up every time I hear that word. Such potential. Anyway, I didn't quite know what to do, so what I did was I took an inventory. I'm up to my fourth step now because I've learned the three essentials. Okay. Honesty, open-minded, and willingness out of the first three steps. And that means, I can't, he can, so let him. Now, in that third step, it says that this is the keystone. The first two steps are our basic steps. They're the cornerstone. The third step is the keystone. I didn't know what a keystone was, so I'm back in my dictionary again, right? And if you can envision an arcway, because it said that is in this third step that we walk through the arcway of freedom, freedom from the bondage of self. Now, it told me that the keystone was the stone that is placed in that arcway of freedom that everything else in our program is connected to. Our first two steps are connected to that, and everything thereafter is connected to our third step. And if that step is not firmly in place and our troubles begin, can I say that? When the shit hits the fan, if you'll pardon the expression, I can't think of a better way to explain it. I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying, because that step is so vital, and it happens in all of our lives. Like I said, you know, everybody has problems. If you are breathing in and out, you're going to have problems. And when the trouble begins, if that third step is not firmly in place, your whole program is going to go right out from under you. And that's where I had my problems, right there at that L&S clubhouse with the men helping me with my spiritual program. And I needed that good, firm, basic program that my sponsor had talked about. It says in that third step that the first requirement is that we lead and believe that any life led on self-will can hardly be a success. That's the first requirement. And as I said, you've already heard me say I was submissive and subservient. I've never been that way since, I want you to know that. Not since I married him, anyway. I found out what was wrong, and I did something about it, right? Isn't that what the whole program teaches us? Stop doing what you're doing that's causing you to hurt. I was tired of hurting, so I stopped being submissive and subservient. I found out for me, you know, that there was rules that I had to go by, and I had always made man my God. Now, my husband told you last night that we cannot create God. Well, I didn't need to create God. They already were in my eyes, see. But what I found out for me, that I couldn't do this any longer, because if I did, I was going to stay in trouble. And so I had to have God first in my life, then me, then those around me in the order of importance to me. And I hope to God that never again do I allow anybody to come between me and God. Never again. God first in my life. The rules. That's the way it goes. And I learned that in that third step. It says God will provide for us what we need if we stay close to Him and do His work well. His work. And do it well. And that's what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know you're going to get tired of hearing me say this, but I'm going to repeat it again. A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourself that will solve our problem is exactly what our program is all about. My book has taught me how to get away from, not how to get away with these things that I was doing when I was drinking. And that was very important to me. Now, in my fourth step, because now was the time for me to take it, let me tell you what I found out about these so-called relationships that I had been having. He was good-looking. He had charm, polish, and prestige. After all, you know, we women deserve that. A lot of you guys got it. He was good-looking, hard-drinking, party-going, woman-chasing. What a challenge, huh? Ooh, boy, you know. And God, when we get them, we don't let go of them. He was killing me, but I wasn't about to let go. Because we all know, you know, the minute we let go of this little son of a gun, he is going to marry her, and all of a sudden he's going to become a sober, loyal, faithful, hardworking husband, right? So we hang on for dear life. You guys do the same thing. Haven't seen you do any different. Look at all the alcoholic women you're married to. You know, because they have such potential. I begin to understand what the book was talking about on page 62 when it says, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-willed run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must get rid of this. We must, or it kills us. I don't know what that did for you, but it scared the hell out of me one more time. And I knew I had to take some kind of an action. I knew I had to take some kind of an action. And again, I remembered something that I had read in the Bible this time. And so I started looking it up. And what I remembered was, it said something to this extent. It said, it was God talking. It was in red. And I was taught when I went to Sunday school as a little kid that anything in red in the Bible was God talking. Okay? It said, I have created man in my image, and for man I have created woman, and woman is to follow man. And I run that through my mind, and I thought to myself, well, you know, I followed three of you son of a guns, and look where I ended up at, the Nut House and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was something wrong somewhere. So I got back into the Bible, and sure enough, I found it in a couple of places, and it said what I thought it said. God said, I have created man in my image, and for man I have created woman, and woman is to be a helpmate to man, and woman is to follow man, and man follows God. You see, I had never finished reading the instructions, the story of my life. And I began to understand what was necessary and the things that I had to learn for this drunk. I had learned the principle of truth in step four, where that inventory is. It says, in this step, we will do some fact-facing and some fact-finding. When we can get honest with ourselves, and thank God I had the principles. You know, a principle to me is the action that I take on a daily basis. It's the way I live my life. And Keith had talked about it last night. It's the way I live my life on a daily basis. And so I began to take the action. Now, today I am married to a man who follows God, but this had never occurred to me before I came to you people. And you taught me this. So life was going along pretty good now. I got to tell you, you know, when I got here, I always thought that it was poor little Nell that was always abused by you men. That you men were just rotten and no good, and that you just walked away from these little affairs you've been practicing your principles in, you know, with no pain, no strain, you know, and it always left us. Well, since being married to an alcoholic on this program, I've had the privilege of holding some of you men in my arms as you've cried over these little affairs you've been having. So I got to tell you, gals, these men do not walk away scot-free always from these relationships. They hurt, too, and they cry, too. So let's us try to be as kind and as honest and as gentle with them as we expect them to be with us. I think that's only fair. This thing is a two-way street. Anyway, there I was. You know, I got to tell you, I don't care when you walked in this program whether you were the biggest streetwalker out there on the streets. When you walk in here, you are reborn. You have become a virgin all over again. I don't care how old or how young you are. And if you don't believe me, you watch these men watching these newcomer women. They can't hardly wait to be the first one. And the sad part of it is they really believe they're going to be the first one. You know. Let me tell you guys something I found out. When you guys want to start loving the hell out of these women instead of the hell that's in them, that's going to be some growth on your part. And when improvement's really going to be there is when you want to be the last one in these women's lives, not the first one. That's improvement with your program. Anyway, here I am, and I have now gotten through the fourth step in which I have learned another principle, and that was the principle of truth. Now, I go on to my fifth step now because I'm ready for that. And what I found in that fifth step, it says that we must tell someone all of our life story, omitting nothing. For if we do, we may not overcome drinking. And then it got even stronger than that, and it went on to say that almost invariably we drank again. Now, one more time, fear and pain was back in my life. It scared the hell out of me. And because, you see, I did not trust my sponsor, and I thought that I had to go to my sponsor and tell her all this stuff and a couple of things I'd never even told my psychiatrist, for God's sake, you know. And here I've got to go to one person or someone and tell them all my life story. And Eunice had a big mouth, and I knew, you know, that she was going to come back here and tell y'all what I had done, and then you were going to ask me to get the heck out of AA. And I didn't know what to do about that, because this was really a big fear in my life. But I kept reading the book, and it kept saying if I didn't do this, you know, that it was going to be a problem here. So I got back in my book again looking for my answers, because it said in the book it gave me my answers. And this is what I found in there. It says that when we grow by our willingness to face and rectify our errors and convert them into assets. That's when we grow. Now, it also said right up underneath there, it said, cling to the thought that in God's hands, our darkest past is the greatest possession we have. For it is the key to life and happiness. And with that key, we avert death and misery for others. God, can you believe that? So I went to Eunice and I told her all of my life story. And when I got to the worst part of it, she sat there and started laughing at me. God, I couldn't believe it. And then she shared a part of her story with me that she had done something similar. She said, honey, I've done that in spades. She said, you're just a baby. I couldn't believe it. But Eunice and I developed a relationship. And it became a relationship of love. And as I then began to work with other women, we also shared. And we developed a relationship. And in most cases, it became a relationship of love. And isn't love God? And isn't God spiritual? And isn't that what the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about? Now, in my sixth and seventh step, and I'm going to close with this, I learned a principle of courage when I was entirely ready to have God remove these defects. And when I went into my seventh step, I learned the principle of faith and a little bit more of humility. I humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings. And what do we have left when our shortcomings are removed? For one thing, we get rid of self-righteousness, and self-worth begins to come into play. But what I had truly left when the defects were removed was peace and harmony and absolute love. And as I close here today, I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the things that I have found. The angers and the frustrations, the joys and the sorrows, and the peace and the serenity. Because you see, these things are life. And life for me, I have found right here in Alcoholics Anonymous with you. Thank you all so very much.